slaves, but there nonetheless. And we, Miss Beardsley, would not be in society, at least not if we left her with the Browns. Here, her potential wealth would matter a great deal more than the colour of her skin. With us, it might be different, for Jamie was, and always would be, despite his income or lack of it, a gentleman. That wasn't the last question after all, I said. I laid a hand over his, cold on my cheek. The last one is, why are you suggesting the notion? Oh, well, I only thought... He dropped his hand and looked away. What you said when we came home from the gathering, that you could have chosen the safety of barrenness, but did not, for my sake. I thought... He stopped again and rubbed the knuckle of his free hand hard along the bridge of his nose. He took a deep breath and tried again. For my sake, he said firmly, addressing the air in front of him as though it were a tribunal, I dinna want you to bear another child. I wouldna risk your loss, Sassenach, he said, his voice suddenly husky. Not for a dozen bairns. I've daughters and sons, nieces and nephews, grandchildren, wains enough. He looked at me directly then, and spoke softly. But I've no life but you, Claire. He swallowed audibly and went on, eyes fixed on mine. I did think, though, if you do want another child, perhaps I could still give you one. Brief tears blurred my eyes. It was cold in the lean-to, and our fingers were stiff. I fumbled my hand into his, squeezing tight. Even as we had spoken, my mind had been busy, envisioning possibilities, difficulties, blessings. I didn't need to think further, for I knew the decision had made itself. A child was a temptation of the flesh as well as of the spirit. I knew the bliss of that unbounded oneness, as I knew the bittersweet joy of seeing that oneness fade as the child learned itself and stood alone. But I had crossed some subtle line. Whether it was that I was born myself with some secret quota embodied in my flesh, or only that I knew my soul allegiance must be given elsewhere now, I knew. As a mother, I had the likeness now of effort complete, honour satisfied, mission accomplished. I leaned my forehead against his chest and spoke into the shadowed cloth above his heart. No, I said softly. But Jamie, I so love you. We stood wrapped in each other's arms for a time, hearing the rumble of voices from the other side of the wall that separated the house from the lean-to, but silent ourselves, and content with the peace of it. We were at once too exhausted to make the effort to go in, and reluctant to abandon the tranquillity of our rude retreat. "We'll have to go in soon," I murmured at last. "If we don't, we'll fall down right here and be found in the morning, along with the hams." A faint wheeze of laughter ran through his chest, but before he could answer, a shadow fell over us. Someone stood in the open door, blocking the moonlight. Jamie lifted his head sharply, hands tight on my shoulders, but then he let his breath out and his grip relaxed, allowing me to step back and turn round.
"Morton,"
Jamie said, in a long-suffering sort of voice,
"what in Christ's name are you doing here?"
Isaiah Morton didn't much look like a rakish seducer, but then, I supposed, tastes must differ. He was slightly shorter than I, but broad through the shoulder, with a barrel-shaped torso and slightly bowed legs. He did have rather pleasant-looking eyes and a nice mop of wavy hair, though I was unable to tell the colour of either in the dim light of the lean-to. I estimated his age at somewhere in the early 20s.
"Colonel, sir," he said in a whisper. "Ma'am."
He gave me a quick, brief bow.
"'D didn't mean to give you fright, ma'am. Only I heard the Colonel's voice and thought I'd best seize the day, so to speak.
Jamie regarded Morton narrowly.
So to speak, he repeated.
Yes, sir. I couldn't make out how I was to get Ally to come forth and was just a circling of the house again when I caught heed of you and your lady talking.
He bowed to me again, as though by reflex.
Morton,
Jamie said, softly, but with a certain amount of steel in his voice.
Why have you not gone? Did Fergus not tell you that the militia is stood down?
Oh, aye, sir, he did, sir.
He bowed to Jamie this time, looking faintly anxious.
But I couldn't go, sir. Not without seeing Ally.
I cleared my throat and glanced at Jamie, who sighed and nodded to me.
I'm afraid that Miss Brown has heard about your prior entanglement, I said delicately.
Eh?
Isaiah looked blank, and Jamie made an irritable noise.
She means the last Kens you've a wife already, he said brutally. And if her father doesn't shoot you on sight, she may stab you to the heart. And if neither of them succeeds, he went on, drawing himself up to his fully menacing height, I'm inclined to do the job myself, wi' my bare hands. What sort of man would slip round a lass and get her with child and him with no right to give it his name?
Isaiah Morton paled noticeably, even in the dim light.
With child?
She is, I said, quite coldly.
She is, Jamie repeated. And now, you wee bigamist, you'd best leave before...
He stopped speaking abruptly as Isaiah's hand came out from under his cloak, holding a pistol.
Close as he was, I could see it was both loaded and cocked.
I'm not sorry, sir, he said apologetically.
He licked his lips, glancing from Jamie to me and back.
I wouldn't do you harm, sir, nor certain your lady, but you see, I just got to see Ally.
His rather pudgy features firmed a little, though his lips seemed inclined to tremble.
Still, he pointed the pistol at Jamie with decision.
Ma'am, he said to me, if might be as you'd be so kind, would you go on into the house and fetch Ally out? We'll just wait here, the Colonel and me.
I hadn't had time to feel afraid.
I wasn't really afraid now, though I was speechless with astonishment.
Jamie closed his eyes briefly as though praying for strength. Then he opened them and sighed, his breath a white cloud in the cold air.
Put it down, idiot, he said almost kindly. Ye ken fine ye willna shoot me, and so do I.
Isaiah tightened both his lips and his trigger finger, and I held my breath. Jamie continued to look at him, his gaze a mixture of censure and pity. At last the finger relaxed, and the pistol barrel sank, along with Isaiah's eyes.
I just got to see Ally, Colonel,
he said softly, looking at the ground. I drew a deep breath and looked up at Jamie. He hesitated, then nodded.
All right, Sassenach. Go canny, aye?
I nodded and turned to slip into the house, hearing Jamie mutter something under his breath in Gaelic behind me, to the general effect that he must have lost his mind. I wasn't sure he hadn't, though I had also felt the strength of Morton's appeal. If any of the Browns happened to discover this rendezvous, though, there would be hell to pay. And it wouldn't be only Morton who paid. The floor inside was littered with sleeping bodies wrapped in blankets, though a few men still huddled round the hearth, gossiping and passing a jug of something spirituous among themselves. I looked carefully, but fortunately Richard Brown wasn't among them. I made my way across the room, carefully stepping through and over the bodies on the floor, and peered into the bed that stood against the wall as I passed. Richard Brown and his wife were both curled up in it, sound asleep, nightcaps pulled well down over their respective ears, though the house was warm enough, what with all the trapped body heat. There was only one place that Alicia Brown could be, and I pushed open the door to the loft stair as quietly as I could. It made little difference. No one by the fire paid the slightest attention. One of the men appeared to be trying to get Hiram to drink from the jug, with some success. By contrast to the room below, the loft was quite cold. This was because the small window was uncovered,
and quite a lot of snow had drifted in, together with a freezing wind. Alicia Brown was lying in the little snowdrift under the window, stark naked. I walked over and stood looking down at her. She lay stiffly on her back, arms folded over her chest. She was shivering, and her eyes were squinched shut with ferocious concentration. Obviously, she hadn't heard my footsteps over the noises from below.
"What in God's name are you doing?" I inquired politely.
Her eyes popped open, and she gave a small shriek. Then she clapped a hand over her mouth and sat up abruptly, staring at me.
"I've heard of a number of novel ways of inducing miscarriage," I told her, picking up a quilt from the cot and dropping it over her shoulders. "But freezing to death isn't one of them."
"If I'm dead, I won't need to miscarry," she said with a certain amount of logic.
Nonetheless, she drew the quilt around her, teeth chattering.
"Scarcely the best means of committing suicide either, I shouldn't think," I said, "though I don't mean to sound critical. Still, you can't do it now. Mr. Morton is out in the lean-to and won't go away until you come down to speak to him, so you'd better get up and put something on."
Her eyes flew wide and she scrambled to her feet, her muscles so stiff with cold that she stumbled awkwardly and would have fallen had I not grabbed her arm. She said nothing more, but dressed as quickly as her chilled fingers would allow, wrapping a thick cloak around herself. Bearing in mind Jamie's adjuration to Golconny, I sent her down the narrow stair alone. Alone, she would be merely assumed to be going to the privy, if anyone even noticed her departure. Both of us together might cause comment. Left by myself in the darkened loft, I drew my own cloak around me and went to the narrow window to wait for the few minutes necessary before I could leave too. I heard the soft thump of the door closing below, but couldn't see Alicia from this high angle. Judging from her response to my summons, she didn't intend to stab Isaiah to the heart. But heaven knew what either of them did intend. The clouds were gone now, and the frozen landscape stretched before me, brilliant and ghostly under a setting moon. Across the road, the horse's brushy shelter stood dark, dappled with clumps of snow. The air had changed, as Jamie had said, and, warmed by the horse's breath, chunks of melting snow slid free and plopped to the ground. In spite of my annoyance with the young lovers and the undertones of comic absurdity attending the whole situation, I couldn't help but feel some sympathy for them. They were so in earnest, so intent on nothing but each other. And Isaiah's unknown wife? I hunched my shoulders, shivering slightly inside my cloak. I should disapprove. I did, in fact. But no one knew the true nature of a marriage, save those who made it. And I was too aware of living in a glass house to think of throwing stones myself. Almost absently, I stroked the smooth metal of my gold wedding ring. Adultery, fornication, betrayal, dishonour. The words dropped softly in my mind like the clumps of falling snow, leaving small dark pits, shadows in moonlight. Excuses could be made, of course. I hadn't sought what had happened to me, had fought against it, had had no choice. Except that, in the end, one always has a choice. I had made mine, and everything had followed from it. Bree, Roger, Jemmy. Any children that might be born to them in the future. All of them were here, in one way or another, because of what I had chosen to do that far-off day on Craignadoon.
"You take too much upon yourself,"
Frank had said that to me many times. Generally in tones of disapproval, meaning that I did things he would have preferred I did not. But now and then in kindness, meaning to relieve me of some burden. It was in kindness that the thought came to me now, whether it was truly spoken or only called forth from my exhausted memory for what comfort the words might hold. Everyone makes choices, and no one knows what may be the end of any of them. If my own was to blame for many things, it was not to blame for everything. Nor was harm all that had come of it. "Till death us do part." There were a great many people who had spoken those vows, only to abandon or betray them.
And yet it came to me that neither death nor conscious choice dissolved some bonds.
For better or for worse, I had loved two men, and some part of them both would be always with me.
The dreadful thing, I suppose, was that while I had often felt a deep and searing regret for what I had done, I had never felt guilt. With the choice so far behind me, now, perhaps, I did. I had apologized to Frank 1,000 times, and never once had I asked him for forgiveness.
It occurred to me suddenly that he had given it, nonetheless, to the best of his ability.
The loft was dark, save for the faint lines of light that seeped through the chinks of the floor, but it no longer seemed empty. I stirred abruptly, pulled from my abstraction by sudden movement below. Silent as flying reindeer, two dark figures darted hand in hand across the field of snow, cloaks like clouds around them. They hesitated for a moment outside the horse's shelter, then disappeared inside. I leaned on the sill, heedless of the snow crystals under my palms. I could hear the noise of the horses rousing. Whickers and stamping came clearly to me across the clear air. The sounds in the house below had grown fainter. Now a clear, loud meh came up through the floorboards as Hiram sensed the horses' uneasiness. There was renewed laughter from below, temporarily drowning the sounds across the road. Where was Jamie? I leaned out, the wind billowing the hood of my cloak, brushing a spray of ice across my cheek. There he was, a tall, dark figure walking across the snow toward the shelter, but going slowly, kicking up white clouds of dusty ice. What? But then I realized that he was following in the lover's tracks, stamping and floundering deliberately, to obliterate a trail that must tell its story clearly to any of the trackers in the house below. A hole appeared suddenly in the brushy shelter as a section of the branched wall fell away. Clouds of steam roiled out into the air, and then a horse emerged carrying two riders, and set off to the west, urged from a walk to a trot, and then a canter. The snow wasn't deep, no more than 3 or 4 inches. The horse's hooves left a clear, dark trail leading down the road. A piercing whinny rose from the shelter, followed by another. Sounds of alarm came from below, scuffling and thuds as men rolled from their blankets or lunged for their weapons. Jamie had disappeared. All at once, horses burst from the shelter, knocking down the wall and trampling the fallen branches. Snorting, whinnying, kicking and jostling, they spilled out over the road in a chaos of flying manes and rolling eyes. The last of them sprang from the shelter and joined the runaway, tail whisking up from the switch that landed on its rump. Jamie flung away the switch and ducked back into the shelter, just as the door below flung open, spilling pale gold light over the scene. I seized the opportunity of the commotion to run downstairs without being seen. Everyone was outside. Even Mrs. Brown had rushed out, nightcap and all, leaving the quilts pulled half off the bed. Hiram, smelling strongly of beer, swayed and meh-ed tipsily at me as I passed, yellow eyes moist and protuberant with conviviality. Outside, the roadway was full of half-dressed men surging to and fro and waving their arms in agitation. I caught sight of Jamie in the midst of the crowd, gesticulating with the best of them. Among the excited bits of question and comment, I heard scraps of speech. Spooked, panther, goddamn, and the like. After a bit of milling around and incoherent argument, it was unanimously decided that the horses would likely come back by themselves. Half of them were hobbled and couldn't go far, and snow was blowing off the trees in veils of whirling ice. The wind struck freezing fingers through every crevice of clothing. "Would you stay out in a night like this?" Roger demanded, reasonably enough. It being generally decided that no sane man would, and horses being, if not quite sane, certainly sensible creatures, the party began to trickle back into the house, shivering and grumbling as the heat of excitement began to die down. Among the last stragglers, Jamie turned toward the house and saw me, still standing on the porch.
His hair was loose, and the light from the open door lit him like a torch. He caught my eye, rolled his own toward heaven, and raised his shoulders in the faintest of shrugs. I put cold fingers to my lips and blew him a small frozen kiss.
This ends Disc 17. The Fiery Cross, Disc 18.
Part 4. I hear no music but the sound of drums. Chapter 33. Home for Christmas.
"What would you have done?" Brianna asked.
She turned over, moving carefully in the narrow confines of Mr. Weems's bed, and parked her chin comfortably in the hollow of Roger's shoulder.
"What would I have done about what?"
Warm through for the first time in weeks, filled to bursting with one of Mrs. Bugg's dinners, and having finally achieved the nirvana of an hour's privacy with his wife, Roger felt pleasantly drowsy and detached. "About Isaiah Morton and Alicia Brown?" Roger gave a jaw-cracking yawn and settled himself deeper, the corn-shuck mattress rustling loudly under them. He supposed the whole house had heard them at it earlier, and he didn't really care. She'd washed her hair in honour of his homecoming, waves of it spread over his chest, a silky rich gleam in the dim glow of the hearth. It was only late afternoon, but the shutters were closed, giving the pleasant illusion that they were inside a small, private cave.
"I don't know. What your dad did, I suppose. What else? Your hair smells great."
He smoothed a lock of it around his finger, admiring the shimmer.
"Thanks. I use some of the stuff Mama makes with walnut oil and marigolds. What about Isaiah's poor wife in Granite Falls, though?" "What about her? Jamie couldn't force Morton to go home to her, assuming that she wants him back," he added logically. "And the girl, Alicia, was evidently more than willing. Your father couldn't very well have made a kerfuffle about Morton leaving with her unless he wanted the man dead. If the Browns had found Morton there, they'd have killed him on the spot and nailed his hide to their barn door."
He spoke with conviction, remembering the pointed guns that had greeted him in Brownsville. He smoothed the hair behind her ear and lifted his head far enough to kiss her between the eyebrows. He'd been imagining that for days, that smooth, pale space between the heavy brows. It seemed like a tiny oasis among the vivid danger of her features. The flash of eyes and blade of nose were more than attractive, to say nothing of a mobile brow and a wide mouth that spoke its mind as much by its shape as by its words. But not peaceful. After the last 3 weeks, he was in a mood for peace. He sank back on the pillow, tracing the stern arch of one ruddy brow with a finger.
"I think the best he could do under the circumstances was to give the young lovers a bit of room to get safe away," he said. "And they did. By the morning, the snow was already melting to mud, and with all the trampling, you couldn't have told whether a regiment of bears had marched through, let alone which way they were going."
He spoke with feeling. The weather had turned suddenly to a warm thaw, and the militia had returned to their homes in good spirits, but muddy to the eyebrows. Brianna sighed, her breath raising a pleasant goose flesh across his chest. She lifted her own head a little, peering in interest.
"What? Have I got filth stuck to me still?"
He had washed, but in haste, eager to eat, more eager to get to bed.
"No, I just like it when you get goosebumps. All the hairs on your chest stand up, and so do your nipples."
She flicked one of the objects in question lightly with a fingernail, and a fresh wave of goose flesh raced across his chest for her entertainment. He arched his back a little, then relaxed.
"No, he'd have to go downstairs soon to deal with the evening chores. He'd heard Jamie go out already."
"Time for a change of subject." He breathed deep, then lifted his head from the pillow, sniffing with interest at the rich aroma seeping through the floor from the kitchen below.
"What's that cooking? A goose? Or geese? A dozen of them?"
thought he caught an odd undertone in her voice, a faint tinge of regret.
"Well, that's great," he said, running a lingering hand down the length of her back. A pale gold down covered her back and shoulders, invisible save when there was candlelight behind her, as there was now. "What's the occasion? For our homecoming?"
She lifted her head from his chest and gave him what he privately classified as a look.
"For Christmas," she said. "What?"
He groped blankly, trying to count the days, but the events of the last 3 weeks had completely erased his mental calendar.
"When?" "Tomorrow, idiot," she said with exaggerated patience.
She leaned over and did something unspeakably erotic to his nipple, then heaved herself up in a rustle of bedclothes, leaving him bereft of blissful warmth and exposed to chilly draughts.
"Didn't you see all the greenery downstairs when you came in? Lizzie and I made the little Chisholm monsters go out with us to cut evergreens. We've been making wreaths and garlands for the last 3 days."
The words were somewhat muffled as she wormed her way into her shift, but he thought she sounded only incredulous rather than angry.
He could hope.
He sat up and swung his feet down, toes curling as they came in contact with the cold boards of the floor. His own cabin had a braided rug by the bed, but his cabin was full of chisms at the moment, or so he was informed. He rubbed a hand through his hair, groping for inspiration, and found it.
"I didn't see anything when I came in but you."
That was the simple truth, and evidently honesty was the best policy. Her head popped through the neck hole of her shift, and she gave him a narrow look, which faded into a slow smile as she saw the evident sincerity stamped on his features. She came over to the bed and put her arms around him, enveloping his head in a smother of marigolds, butter-soft linen and milk.
"Oh, aye. The kid would be needing to eat again soon."
Resigned, he put his arms round the swell of her hips and rested his head between her breasts for the few moments that were his own meagre share of that abundance.
"Sorry," he said, words muffled in her warmth. "I'd forgotten it entirely. I'd have brought you and Jem something if I'd thought."
"Like what? A piece of Isaiah Morton's hide?" She laughed and let go, straightening up to smooth her hair. She was wearing the bracelet he'd given her on an earlier Christmas Eve. The half-light glinted off the silver as she lifted her arm.
"Aye, you could cover a book in it, I suppose. Or make a pair of wee boots for Jem."
It had been a long ride, men and horses pushing past tiredness, eager for home. He felt boneless, and would have asked no better present himself than to go back to bed with her, pressed tight together in warmth, to drift toward the inviting depths of deep black sleep and amorous dreams.
"Duty called, though."
He yawned, blinked, and heaved himself up.
"Are the geese for our supper tonight, then?"
he asked, squatting to poke through the discarded pile of mud-caked garments he'd chucked earlier. He might have a clean shirt somewhere, but with the Chisholms in his cabin, and Bree and Jem temporarily lodged here in the Weemses' room, he had no idea where his own things were. No sense to put on something clean, only to go and muck out a byre and feed horses anyway. He'd shave and change before supper.
"Uh-huh. Mrs. Bug has half a hog barbecuing in a pit outside for tomorrow's Christmas dinner. I shot the geese yesterday, though, and she wanted to use them fresh."
"We were hoping you guys would be home in time." He glanced at her, picking up the same undertone in her voice.
"You don't care for goose?" he asked.
She looked down at him with an odd expression.
"I've never eaten one," she answered.
"Roger?"
"Aye."
"I was just wondering. I wanted to ask if you knew..."
"If I knew what?"
He was moving slowly, still wrapped in a pleasant fog of exhaustion and lovemaking. She'd put her gown on, brushed her hair, and put it up neatly in a thick coil on her neck, all in the time it had taken him to disentangle his stockings and breeches. He shook the breeks absent-mindedly, sending a shower of dried mud fragments pattering over the floor.
"Don't do that! What's the matter with you?"
Flushed with sudden annoyance, she snatched the breeks away from him. She thrust open the shutters and leaned out, flapping the garment violently over the sill. She jerked the shaken breeks back in and threw them in his general direction. He dived to catch them.
"Hey, what's the matter with you?"
"Matter? You shower dirt all over the floor and you think there's something wrong with me?"
"Sorry, I didn't think."
She made a noise deep in her throat.
It wasn't very loud, but it was threatening. Obeying a deep-seated masculine reflex, he shoved the leg into his breeches. Whatever might be happening, he'd rather meet it with his trousers on. He jerked them up, talking fast.
"Look, I'm sorry I didn't think of it being Christmas. There were important things to deal with.
I lost track.
I'll make it up to you. Perhaps when we go to Cross Creek for your aunt's wedding, I could..."
"The hell with Christmas!"
"What?"
He stopped, breeks half-buttoned. It was winter dusk and dark in the room, but even by candlelight he could see the colour rising in her face.
"The hell with Christmas, the hell with Cross Creek, and the fucking hell with you too!"
She punctuated this last with a wooden soap dish from the washstand, which whizzed past his left ear and smacked into the wall behind him.
"No, just a fucking minute. Don't you use language like that to me. But you and your important things..."
Her hand tightened on the big china ewer and he tensed, ready to duck. But she thought better of it and her hand relaxed.
"I've spent the last month here up to my eyeballs in laundry and baby shit and screeching women and horrible children while you're out doing important things. And you come marching in here, covered in mud, and tromp all over the clean floors without even noticing they were clean in the first place. Do you have any idea what a pain it is to scrub pine floors on your hands and knees? With lye soap?"
She waved her hands at him in accusation, but too quickly for him to see whether they were covered with gaping sores, rotted off at the wrist, or merely reddened.
"And you don't even want to look at your son or hear anything about him.
He's learned to crawl, and I wanted to show you.
But all you wanted was to go to bed, and you didn't even bother to shave first."
Roger felt as though he'd walked into the blades of a large, rapidly whirling fan. He scratched at his short beard, feeling guilty.
"I thought you wanted to..."
"I did!"
She stamped her foot, raising a small cloud of dust from the disintegrated mud.
"That hasn't got anything to do with it."
"All right."
He bent to get his shirt, keeping one eye warily on her.
"So, you're mad because I didn't notice you'd washed the floor, is that it?"
"No."
"No," he repeated.
He took a deep breath and tried again.
"So, it is that I forgot it's Christmas?"
"No!"
"You're angry that I wanted to make love to you, even though you wanted to do it too?"
"No! Would you just shut up?"
Roger was strongly tempted to accede to this request, but a dogged urge to get to the bottom of things made him push on.
"But I don't understand why..."
"I know you don't. That's the problem."
She spun on her bare heel and stomped over to the chest that stood by the window. She flung back the lid with a bang and began rummaging with a series of small snorts and growls. He opened his mouth, shut it again, and jerked the dirty shirt on over his head. He felt simultaneously irritated and guilty, a bad combination. He finished dressing in an atmosphere of charged silence, considering and rejecting possible remarks and questions, all of which seemed likely to inflame the situation further. She had found her stockings, yanked them on, and gartered them with small savage movements, then thrust her feet into a pair of battered clogs. Now she stood at the open window, drawing deep breaths of air as though she were about to perform a set of RAF exercises. His inclination was to escape while she wasn't looking, but he couldn't bring himself simply to leave with something wrong, whatever in God's name it was,
between them. He could still feel the sense of closeness that they had shared less than a quarter of an hour before, and couldn't bring himself to believe that it had simply evaporated into thin air. He walked up behind her, slowly, and put his hands on her shoulders. She didn't whirl round and try either to stamp on his foot or to knee him in the stones, so he took the risk of kissing her lightly on the back of the neck.
"You were going to ask me something about geese?"
She took a deep breath and let it out in a sigh, relaxing just a little against him. Her anger seemed to have vanished as quickly as it had appeared, leaving him baffled but grateful. He put his arms round her waist and pulled her back against him.
"Yesterday," she said, "Mrs. Abernathy burnt the biscuits for breakfast."
"Or?"
"Mrs. Bug accused her of being too taken up with her daughter's hair ribbons to pay attention to what she was doing."
"And what was she doing," Mrs. Bug said, "putting blueberries into buttermilk biscuits in the first place?"
"Why shouldn't one put blueberries into buttermilk biscuits?"
"I have no idea. But Mrs. Bug doesn't think you should. And then Billy MacLeod fell down the stairs and his mother was nowhere to be found. She went to the privy and got stuck and..."
"She what?"
Mrs. MacLeod was short and rather stout, but had a well-defined rear aspect, with an arse like two cannonballs in a sack. It was all too easy to envision such an accident befalling her, and Roger felt laughter gurgle up through his chest. He tried manfully to stifle it, but it emerged through his nose in a painful snort.
"We shouldn't laugh."
"She had splinters."
Despite this rebuke, Brianna herself was quivering against him, tremors of mirth fracturing her voice.
"Christ! What then?"
"Well, Billy was screaming. He didn't break anything, but he banged his head pretty hard. And Mrs. Bug shot out of the kitchen with her broom, hollering because she thought we were being attacked by Indians. And Mrs. Chisholm went to find Mrs. MacLeod and started yelling from the privy and... Well, anyway, the geese came over in the middle of all of it, and Mrs. Bug looked up at the ceiling with her eyes popping and then said, 'Geese!' so loud that everyone stopped yelling, and she ran into Dar's study and came back with the fowling piece and shoved it at me."
She'd relaxed a little with the telling. She snorted and settled back against him.
"I was so mad. I really wanted to kill something.
And there were a lot of them, the geese. You could hear them calling all across the sky."
He had seen the geese, too. Black V-shapes flexing in the winds of the upper air, arrowing their way through the winter sky. Heard them calling, with a strange feeling of loneliness at the heart, and wished she were beside him there. Everyone had rushed out to watch. The wild Chisholm children and a couple of the half-wild Chisholm dogs went scampering through the trees with whoops and barks of excitement to retrieve the fallen birds, while Brianna shot and reloaded as quickly as she could. One of the dogs got one, and Toby tried to wrestle it away, and the dog bit him. And he was running around and around the yard, screaming that his finger was bitten off, and there was blood all over him, and no one could make him stop so we could see whether it was, and... Mama wasn't here, and Mrs. Chisholm was down by the creek with the twins. She was stiffening again, and he could see the hot blood rising once more, flushing the back of her neck. He tightened his hold on her waist.
"Was his finger bitten off, then?"
She stopped and took a deep breath, then looked round at him over her shoulder, the colour fading slightly from her face.
"No, the skin wasn't even broken. It was goose blood." "Well, so, you did well, didn't you? The larder full, not a finger lost, and the house still standing."
He'd meant it as a joke, and was surprised to feel her heave a deep sigh, a little of the tension going out of her.
"Yes," she said,
and her voice held a note of undeniable satisfaction.
"I did. All present and accounted for, and everybody fed. With minimal bloodshed," she added. "Well, it's true what they say about omelettes and eggs, eh?"
He laughed and bent to kiss her, then remembered his beard.
"Oh, Sorry. I'll go and shave, shall I?
No, don't. She turned as he released her and brushed a fingertip across his jaw. I sort of like it.
Besides, you can do that later, can't you?
Aye, I can.
He bent his head and kissed her gently but thoroughly. Was that it, then?
She'd only wanted him to say that she'd done well, left on her own to run the place.
He was thinking she deserved it, if so. He'd known she hadn't been only sitting by the hearth singing cradle songs to Jemmy in his absence. But he hadn't envisioned the gory details. The smell of her hair and the musk of her body was all round him. But breathing deep to get more of it, he realised that the room was fragrant with juniper and balsam too, and the mellow scent of beeswax candles. Not just one. There were three of them, set in candlesticks about the room. Normally she would have lit a rush dip, saving the valuable candles. But the small room glowed now with a soft gold light, and he realised that the bloom of it had lit them through their lovemaking, leaving him with memories of russet and ivory and the gold down that covered her like a lion's pelt, the shadowed crimson and purple of her secret places, the dark of his skin on the paleness of hers, memories that glowed vivid against the white sheets in his mind. The floor was clean, or had been, its white pine boards scrubbed and the corners strewn with dried rosemary. He could see the tumbled bed past her ear and realised that she'd made it up with fresh linen and a new quilt. She'd taken trouble for his homecoming. And he'd come barging in, brimming with his adventures, expecting praise for the feat of coming back alive, and seeing none of it, blind to everything in his urgent need to get his hands on her and feel her body under his.
He said softly in her ear, I may be a fool, but I love you, aye?
She sighed deeply, her breasts pushing against his bare chest, warm even through the cloth of shift and gown. They were firm, filling with milk, but not yet hard.
Yeah, you are, she said frankly, but I love you too, and I'm glad you're home.
He laughed and let go. There was a branch of juniper tacked above the window, heavy with its clouded blue-green berries. He reached up and broke off a sprig, kissed it, and tucked it into the neck of her gown, between her breasts, as a token of truce and apology.
Merry Christmas. Now, what was it about the geese?
She put a hand to the juniper sprig, a half-smile growing, then fading.
Oh, well, it's not important, it's just...
He followed the direction of her eyes, turned, and saw the sheet of paper propped up behind the basin on the washstand. It was a drawing done in charcoal. Wild geese against a stormy sky, striving through the air above a lash of wind-tossed trees. It was a wonderful drawing, and looking at it gave him the same odd feeling at the heart that hearing the geese themselves had done. Half joy, half pain.
Merry Christmas, Brianna said softly behind him.
She came to stand beside him, wrapping a hand around his arm.
Thanks. It's... God, Bree, you're good.
She was. He bent and kissed her hard, needing to do something to lessen the sense of yearning that haunted the paper in his hand.
Look at the other one.
She pulled a little away from him, still holding his arm, and nodded at the washstand. He hadn't realised there were two. The other drawing had been behind the first.
She was good. Good enough to chill the blood at his heart.
The second drawing was in charcoal too. The same stark blacks and whites and greys. In the first, she had seen the wildness of the sky and put it down. Yearning and courage. Effort enduring in faith amid the emptiness of air and storm. In this, she had seen stillness. It was a dead goose, hung by its feet, its wings half spread. Neck limp and beak half open, as though even in death it sought flight and the loud calling company of its companions. The lines of it were grace, the details of feather, beak, and empty eyes exquisite. He had never seen anything so beautiful, nor so desolate in his life. "I drew that last night," she said quietly. "Everybody was in bed, but I couldn't sleep." She had taken a candlestick and prowled the crowded house, restless, going outside at last in spite of the cold, seeking solitude, if not rest, in the chill dark of the outbuildings. And in the smoke shed, by the light of the embers there, had been struck by the beauty of the hanging geese, their clear plumage black and white against the sooty wall. I checked to be sure Jemmy was sound asleep, then brought my sketch-box down and drew until my fingers were too cold to hold the charcoal any more. That was the best one. She nodded at the picture, her eyes remote. For the first time he saw the blue shadows in her face and imagined her by candlelight, up late at night and all alone, drawing dead geese. He would have taken her in his arms then, but she turned away, going to the window where the shutters had begun to bang. The thaw had faded, to be followed by a freezing wind that stripped the last sere leaves from the trees and sent acorns and chestnut hulls sailing through the air to rattle on the roof like buckshot. He followed her, reached past her to draw in the shutters and fasten them against the bitter wind. "Dar told me stories while I was waiting for Jemmy to be born. I wasn't paying close attention," the corner of her mouth quirked with wryness, "but a bit here and there stuck with me." She turned around then and leaned against the shutters, hands gripping the sill behind her. "He said, when a hunter kills a greylag goose, he must wait by the body, because the greylag mate for life. And if you kill only one, the other will mourn itself to death. So you wait, and when the mate comes, you kill it too." Her eyes were dark on his, but the candle flames struck glints of blue in their depths. "What I wondered is, are all geese like that? Not only greylags." She nodded at the pictures. He touched her and cleared his throat. He wanted to comfort her, but not at the price of an easy lie. "Maybe so. I don't know for sure, though. You're worried, then, about the mates of the birds you shot?" The soft, pale lips pressed tight together, then relaxed. "Not worried, just... I couldn't help thinking about it afterward. About them flying on, alone. You were gone. I couldn't help thinking. I mean, I knew you were all right this time, but next time you might not come. Well, never mind. It's just silly. Don't worry about it." She stood up and would have pushed past him into the room, but he put his arms around her and held her close so she couldn't see his face. He knew that she didn't absolutely require him, not to make hay, to plough, to hunt for her. If needs must, she could do those things herself, or find another man. And yet, the wild geese said she needed him, would mourn his loss if it ever came, perhaps forever. In his present vulnerable mood, that knowledge seemed a great gift. "Geese," he said at last, his voice half muffled in her hair. "The next-door neighbours kept geese when I was a wee lad. Big white buggers, six of them. They went round in a gang, all high-nosed and honking. Terrorised dogs and children and folk that passed by on the street." "Did they terrorise you?" Her breath tickled warm on his collarbone. "Oh, aye, all the time. When we played in the street, they'd rush out honking and peck at us and beat us with their wings. When I wanted to go out into the back garden to play with a mate, Mrs. Graham would have to come too to drive the bastards off to their own yard with a broomstick. Then the milkman came by one morning while the geese were in their front garden.
They went for him, and he ran for his float, and his horse took fright at all the honking and screeching and stamped two of the geese flatter than bannocks. The kids on the street were all thrilled. She was laughing against his shoulder, half shocked but amused. What happened then? Mrs. Graham took them and plucked them, and we had goose pie for a week, he said matter-of-factly. He straightened up and smiled at her. She was flushed and rosy. That's what I ken about geese. They're wicked buggers, but they taste great. He turned and plucked his mud-stained coat from the floor. So then, let me help your da with the chores. And then I want to see how you've taught my son to crawl.
Chapter 34 Charms.
I touched a finger to the gleaming white surface, then rubbed my fingers together appraisingly. There is absolutely nothing greasier than goose grease, I said with approval. I wiped my fingers on my apron and took up a large spoon. Nothing better for a nice pastry crust, Mrs. Bug agreed. She stood on her tiptoes, watching jealously as I divided the soft white fat, ladling it from one kettle into two large stone crocks, one for the kitchen, one for my surgery. A nice venison pie we'll have for Hogmanay, she said, eyes narrowing as she envisioned the prospect. And the haggis to follow, wee cullen skink and a bit of corn crowdie, and a great raisin tart wee jam and clotted cream for sweeties. Wonderful, I murmured. My own immediate plans for the goose grease involved a salve of wild sarsaparilla and bittersweet for burns and abrasions, a mentholated ointment for stuffy noses and chest congestion, and something soothing and pleasantly scented for diaper rash. Perhaps a lavender infusion, with the juice of crushed jewelweed leaves. I glanced down in search of Jemmy. He had learned to crawl only a few days before, but was already capable of an astonishing rate of speed, particularly when no one was looking. He was sitting peaceably enough in the corner, though, gnawing intently at the wooden horse Jamie had carved for him as a Christmas present. Catholic, as many of them were, and nominally Christian, as they all were, Highland Scots regarded Christmas primarily as a religious observance rather than a major festive occasion. Lacking priest or minister, the day was spent much like a Sunday, though with a particularly lavish meal to mark the occasion and the exchange of small gifts. My own gift from Jamie had been the wooden ladle I was presently using, its handle carved with the image of a mint leaf. I had given him a new shirt with a ruffle at the throat for ceremonial occasions, his old one having worn quite away at the seams. With a certain amount of forethought, Mrs. Bug, Brianna, Marsali, Lizzie and I had made up an enormous quantity of molasses toffee, which we had distributed as a Christmas treat to all the children within earshot. Whatever it might do to their teeth, it had the beneficial effect of gluing their mouths shut for long periods, and in consequence, the adults had enjoyed a peaceful Christmas. Even Germaine had been reduced to a sort of tuneful gargle. Hogmanay was a different kettle of fish, though. God knew what feverish pagan roots the Scottish New Year's celebration sprang from, but there was a reason why I wanted to have a good lot of medicinal preparations made up in advance. The same reason Jamie was now up at the whisky spring, deciding which barrels were sufficiently aged as not to poison anyone. The goose grease disposed of, there was a good bit of dark broth left in the bottom of the kettle, a swirl with bits of crackled skin and shreds of meat. I saw Mrs. Bug eyeing it, visions of gravy dancing in her brain. Half, I said sternly, reaching for a large bottle. She didn't argue, merely shrugged her rounded shoulders and settled back on her stool in resignation. Whatever will you do with that, though? She asked curiously, watching as I put a square of muslin over the neck of the bottle in order to strain the broth. Grease? Aye, it's a wonder for the salves. And broth's good for a body with the ague, or a wobbly wheen, to be sure. But it will na keep, you know. One sketchy eyebrow lifted at me in warning, in case I hadn't actually known that. Leave it more than a day or two, and it'll be blue with the mould. Well, I do hope so, I told her, ladling broth into the muslin square.
I've just set out a batch of bread to mould, and I want to see if it will grow on the broth, too. I could see assorted questions and responses flickering through her mind, all based on a growing fear that this mania of mine for rotten food was expanding and would soon engulf the entire output of the kitchen. Her eyes darted toward the pie safe, then back at me, dark with suspicion. I turned my head to hide a smile and found Adso the kitten balanced on his hind legs on the bench, foreclaws anchored in the tabletop, his big green eyes watching the movements of the ladle with fascination. "Oh, you want some too?" I reached for a saucer from the shelf and filled it with a dark puddle of broth, savoury with bits of goose meat and floating fat globules. "This is from my half," I assured Mrs. Bug, but she shook her head vigorously. "Not a bit of it, Mrs. Freezer," she said. "The bonny wee laddie's caught 6 mice in here in the past 2 days." She beamed fondly at Adso, who had leapt down and was lapping broth as fast as his tiny pink tongue could move. "Yon cheetie's welcome to anything he likes from my hearth." "Oh, has he? Splendid. He can come and have a go at the ones in my surgery, then." We were presently entertaining a plague of mice, driven indoors by cold weather. They skittered along the baseboards like shadows after nightfall, and even in broad daylight shot suddenly across floors and leapt out of open cupboards, causing minor heart failures and broken dishes. "Well, you can scarcely blame the mice," Mrs. Bug observed, darting a quick glance at me. "They go where the food is, after all." The pool of broth had nearly drained through the muslin, leaving a thick coating of flotsam behind. I scraped this off and dropped it on Adzo's saucer, then scooped up a fresh ladle of broth. "Yes, they do," I said evenly. "And I'm sorry about it, but the mould is important. It's medicine, and I..." "Oh, aye, of course it is," she assured me hurriedly. "I ken that." There was no tinge of sarcasm in her voice, which rather surprised me. She hesitated, then reached through the slit in her skirt into the capacious pocket that she wore beneath. "There was a man as lived in Ochterlony, where we had our house, Arch and me, in the village there. He was a carlin, was Johnny Howlett, and folk went wary near him. But they went. Some went by day for grass cures and grease, and some went by night for to buy charms. You'll ken the sort." She darted another glance at me, and I nodded a little uncertainly. I knew the sort of person she meant. Some Highland charmers dealt not only in remedies, the graiths she'd mentioned, but also in minor magic, selling love filters, fertility potions, ill wishes. Something cold slid down my back and vanished, leaving in its wake a faint feeling of unease, like the slime trail of a snail. I swallowed, seeing in memory the small bunch of thorny plants so carefully bound with red thread and with black, placed beneath my pillow by a jealous girl named Lyra, purchased from a witch named Jealous Duncan. A witch like me. Was that what Mrs. Bug was getting at? Carlin wasn't a word I was certain of, though. I thought it meant witch or something like that. She was regarding me thoughtfully, her normal animation quite subdued. "He was a filthy wee manny, Johnny Howlett was. He'd no woman to do for him, and his cot smelt of dreadful things. So did he." She shivered suddenly, in spite of the fire at her back. "You'd see him sometimes in the wood or on the moor, poking at the ground. He'd find creatures that had died, maybe, and bring back their skins and their feet, bones and teeth, for to make his charms. He wore a wretched old smock like a farmer, and sometimes you'd see him coming down the path with something pushed up under his smock and stains of blood and other things seeping through the cloth." "Sounds most unpleasant," I said, eyes fixed on the bottle as I scraped the cloth again and ladled more broth. "But people went to him anyway." "There was no one else," she said simply, and I looked up. Her dark eyes fixed unblinkingly on mine, and her hand moved slowly, fingering something inside her pocket. "I didn't ken at first," she said, "for Johnny kept mool from the graveyard and bone dust and hen's blood and all manner of such things, But you... She nodded thoughtfully at me, white kerch immaculate in the fire glow. You're a cleanly sort. Thank you, I said, both amused and tired.